clouds. Okay. Hello, my name is Len Baer, also known as P. Sardonicus on Twitter. Today is July 7th, 2022, and this is the first installment of Conversations with Experts. Today's expert is Dr. Armin Krishnan, Assistant Professor and Director of Security Studies at East Carolina University. How are you doing, Dr. Krishnan?
Good morning, Len. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to join the conversation.
Excellent. So can I call you Armin?
Yes, please do.
Yeah. Okay, Armin, it's such a pleasure to have you. A couple of weeks ago, we had a conversation about my diagnosed case of Havana syndrome, but this is today is about you, about your work, about your book, what's on your mind, and I'm really delighted to have you to have a conversation with you. I have this book that absolutely underappreciated. You published it in 2018. Published by Routledge, I think. It's called Military Neuroscience and the Coming Age of Neurowarfare. This book is absolutely terrified me. But where I would like to start is to ask you, what are you an expert in, Dr. Krishnan? Armin, sorry.
I'm a political scientist. I started out in political philosophy, and then I switched to security studies, so that deals with international and national security. I have an interest in military technology, intelligence, and covert operations. So I became interested in neuroscience or military neuroscience because of earlier research that I did. So I wrote a book on autonomous weapons, and that included some discussion of directed energy weapons. And I was seeing that something important was going on in that area. And I wanted to dig deeper into it. And I always had some interest in fringe scientific topics, such as mind control. And that's the reason why I thought it was a good idea to write the book. And obviously, there was another important book that came out much earlier than mine by Jonathan Moreno. So Mind Wars. So that inspired me that there's something to it. So as you know, the mainstream opinion about mind control is that's a hoax. It doesn't work. It's mostly a conspiracy theory. And most people are satisfied with that answer. And I wanted to challenge that. So I think that mind control is very real, and that practically everybody who is alive today is under some kind of mind control. So some people are more susceptible to it than other people. And there are different kinds of techniques and technologies that are being used. So nobody is free of that. And that is something that concerns me a lot. And I think the public needs to be made more aware of what is at stake. And that is individual freedom and autonomy. Mm-hmm. So we are more and more drawn into a kind of system that is inhumane and that is totalitarian in nature. And that is based on very advanced technology. And that deprives us of our human experience. And I want to oppose that in the little contribution that I can make.
And the contribution that you made with this book is absolutely fantastic. It's so well researched. It's so well referenced. You give us a framework of what neuroweapons are, and I think when you talk about the topic of mind control, and you distinguish between sort of the media influence and the neuroweapon influence. Like, how does this, how are these things related? What part of it you assign to neuroweapons and what part of it you assign to other things?
I mean, there are the behavioral sciences that try to understand how we process information and how we learn and how we come to conclusions, how we think, and mm-hmm. that influences our behavior. And that kind of research has been going on for a long time. So that deals with propaganda. So influencing people by the way of using information and by using particular kind of messaging. And that has become very sophisticated. Some of it targets the subconscious. So the part of the mind that we are not consciously aware of and that still influences us in a major way. So many things we do without actually thinking about it. And that is easy to exploit. And so we are now at the stage where we can more directly manipulate the brain. So that's where the neuroscience and neurotechnologies come into play. So there are various forms of brain stimulation that allows us to induce auditory and visual hallucinations into people, even take control of their body using things like transcranial magnetic stimulation. So we can stimulate particular areas of the brain with strong magnetic fields and then trigger action. So it has been demonstrated that one can control the hand of another person using transcranial magnetic stimulation. And yeah, we can take it even further, implant electrodes into the brain and exercise much more control over a person or an animal. And all of that has been already demonstrated in the 1960s. So there's a long research agenda that has been going on. So that's not really something very new, but I think it's becoming also much more sophisticated. So we are getting to the point that we don't actually need to implant any electrodes into our brain in order to monitor brain processes or influence processes in the brain and thereby thinking and behavior and mental states and things like that.
That part, that remote aspect of this brain stimulation or mind control is very hard for people to imagine. What would you suggest? We're having a conversation, we understand the technological possibilities, but most of the people are not. How would you phrase it convincingly so people would understand that it can be done remotely without without actual electrons attached to your head or some kind of device or helmet? How would you phrase it? How would you frame it for people to understand?
But I think it's important to go back into the history of mind control and how it was developed. So the starting point, I think, is hypnosis. Mm-hmm. So that was discovered in the late 18th century by Franz Anton Mesmer, and he already connected it to magnetism. So in the 19th century, there was already a lot of research going on in that area of hypnosis and connection to electromagnetism. And that has become more and more advanced over time. During the Cold War, there was a lot of speculation about something called psychotronic weapons. The main idea here that you could somehow collect and use psychic energies in order to influence other people. And obviously that was very controversial and remains very controversial. So we have only limited documentation of that. We know that there was psychic research going on in the Soviet Union, especially in the 1960s, 1970s, and into the 1980s. So there is a very good book by Sheila Ostrander and Lynn Schroeder about psychic discoveries of the East. So we also know that the CIA was very interested in that kind of unusual research. So there was some money given to the Stanford Research Institute in the early 1970s, and they had some weird research going on called remote viewing. So the idea was that you could train people to gather information by focusing the mind on a particular location and then draw what they were seeing. So I don't know whether that is a real thing or not. My impression is that it was a cover for some other things going on. I think that there is a connection to directed energy, electromagnetic waves, spectrum, in particular microwaves. So that was also an interesting area that was taking off in the 1950s. And maybe I should mention the Moscow signal. So you're certainly familiar with that. So in the late 1950s, the CIA was conducting a bug sweep in the Moscow embassy, and they were discovering that the Soviets were bombarding a particular corner of the embassy with microwaves. And they decided to monitor that. Initial idea was that they were just eavesdropping. And in particular, they found a bug hidden in a carved wood statue that was passive, so that could be activated with microwaves. And that indicated this was just some eavesdropping. But over the years, there was a lot of variation in the energy density and the frequencies. And they thought something else must be going on here. And the microwave bombardment became more intense. So it was covering different areas of the embassy as well. And that led to the start of Project Pandora. So that was a DARPA project where they were investigating the influence of of electromagnetic fields on biological organisms and also the human mind. So they were conducting that research from 65 to 1970. The results were inconclusive. So some of the Pandora scientists believed that the microwaves did have bio effects and that you could influence people, including putting people in a state of hypnosis. So that was also the time when MKUltra was still going on. So that was a CIA research project that was started in 1953, continued until 1964, and then was renamed MKSearch. So MKSearch was an in-house program in the CIA that was more tightly controlled. And that continued until the early 70s, I think 72 or so. And in this MKUltra research, there was a lot of drug-related research. So they were trying to influence the human mind using various kinds of drugs. The most prominent one was LSD. There was a lot of research related to hypnosis. And there was also research related to electromagnetic fields. including microwave type of research and how it could be used for inducing hypnosis and other kinds of bio effects. So we know that there was a lot of government-sponsored research into that kind of idea of using electromagnetic waves for producing bio effects, including influencing the mind. And we know that they conducted that research over a period of almost 20 years. I mean, that is documented. And we know that it involved some of the top universities and top researchers in the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom. And it's very hard to imagine that they would not have come with something. So you would think if it was a dead end, if it was just not possible, if there are no bioeffects of electromagnetic waves and so on, they would have stopped it. And I don't think that ever happened.
Yep.
So one theory behind the Moscow signal is that it was a deliberate effort by the Soviets to damage the health of the embassy personnel. And that was potentially a retaliation for the eavesdropping that was going on from the American embassy in Moscow. And in 1976, there was, I think, a New York Times article that leaked the story. It suggested that two American ambassadors to Moscow had died of cancer. And then there was a third one who was suffering from leukemia, and that there were other embassy personnel who had suffered in their health because of being in that embassy. And so there was a study done by Johns Hopkins University in the late 1970s. That study suggested that there was no higher incidence rate of cancer of the embassy personnel compared to the general population, and it was kind of dismissed. What is notable about the story is that the State Department did pay out money for hardship to the affected embassy personnel. And it seems there was some kind of cover-up happening about it. So I believe that there was an intention to harm the US embassy personnel, and that it may have also happened in other embassies across Eastern Europe. So there was another study done in the mid-1990s looking at the data from Johns Hopkins and coming to different conclusions about it. So I think that bioeffects of microwaves or other electromagnetic fields are real. And I think that there is a lot of research that can document that. And I think that it also has, in fact, it affects the brain, and that you can influence mental states and well-being using electromagnetic fields and microwaves. So that is one kind of technology that has been looked into. And I think there's a good case that can be made that you can potentially also monitor mental states or brain waves remotely using this kind of technology. So microwaves are used in radars. So that is how they were originally developed. So you can beam the microwaves at an object, and then an echo comes back, and then you can determine that there is an object that was reflecting those waves. And I think that same principle is possible with brainwaves as well. So we are electrochemical beings.
Right.
Our nervous system uses electricity and chemical processes. And that's the reason that I think you can influence the nervous system using electromagnetic fields.
Right. Thank you very much for this overview. I really appreciate the historic aspects of this technology, but most of it stops in the 70s, and we had 50 years of development that has been going undercover. And so I'm trying to imagine what this technology after 50 years of technological advancement might look like. I'd like to go back to your definition of neuroweapons that you give in your book. It's neuroweapons are weapons that specifically target the brain or the central nervous system in order to affect the targeted person's mental state, mental capacity, and ultimately the person's behavior in a specific and predictable way. Can you come up with some examples of what this technology might do today? Like, just give us some idea today about the extent of the possibilities what it can do today, given the 50 years of continuing research.
I think there was a scientific breakthrough in terms of brain imaging, and that happened in the 1990s. So this makes it possible to understand what is going on inside of the brain in a much more detailed manner. So we can better understand what kind of areas of the brain are responsible for what kind of processes that are happening. And that provides an opportunity to to manipulate what is going on inside of the brain in a particular manner. And as I mentioned before, I think it's possible to induce hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, and visual hallucinations in the brain by stimulating particular brain areas. And that can be done with invasive as well as non-invasive technologies. So there is the possibility of wearing some kind of helmet so that is applied directly to the brain. So that can use strong electromagnetic fields, but it can also use ultrasound. And then you can target particular brain areas. So for example, you could relieve stress or pain. So that is possible. It has been demonstrated that it can be done. So up to now, I mean, what is publicly known is that we can do it with a helmet kind of device. And we have brain imaging technology as well and so on. So it is also known that we can use implants for that. So there was also a controversial DARPA project where they implanted people with post-traumatic stress syndrome with electrodes. So it was called deep brain stimulation. And they were using that to relieve stress and pain. So we can affect the mental state in a particular manner. Using those both invasive as well as non-invasive technologies. And where it gets very controversial is the question whether you can do it clandestinely or covertly and remotely. So that is something that is being denied. So we don't have a whole lot of hard scientific evidence for that. We know that directed energy weapons exist. So we can potentially inflict pain remotely. So there's the active denial system, which was a research project, I think also sponsored by DARPA in the 1990s, was declassified in 2000. So the main idea is to generate millimeter waves. So those produce a burning sensation on the skin to people who are exposed to that. And it has a range of at least a couple of hundred meters. And at that time when it was declassified, it was still very bulky. So it had to be placed on a truck and it required a lot of logistics. So it had to be fired up something like 12 hours before use. And that made it very impractical. And they later said that this kind of technology was a dead end. I think that this technology has been miniaturized so that it is possible to induce pain using this kind of technology over distance.
So, of course, we have this case of so-called Havana syndrome that has been in the news, that has been under investigation. As far as we know, there are no electrodes, there were no implants, and yet people were targeted sometimes in the same apartment. There were people who experienced it, the noise and the cognitive complaints and the vestibular complaints and et cetera, et cetera. And there were people who were not affected. So that raises a question. How could they be targeted without electrode implants remotely? Can you imagine some mechanisms how it could be accomplished?
Well, the original theory behind the Havana syndrome was that it was an acoustic weapon, so that it was based on either infrasound or ultrasound. And so these are inaudible sound waves. At least ultrasound can be directed in a beam. I don't think it's possible with infrasound. You would have to be very close with infrasound to affect somebody. So if it was acoustic based, it would be ultrasound, and ultrasound can be directed in a beam. So you could target a particular person with that. there were other kinds of theories about it. I think there is a National Academy of Sciences report on the Havana syndrome. They've looked at different explanations. One other explanation was exposure to some neurotoxins, so chemical or biological agents were discussed. And another explanation that they came up with was pulsed microwaves. And that is one of the very few official reports that I've seen that discuss pulsed microwaves as a mechanism for inducing harm to people. So the whole idea that microwaves are harmful is very much debated for one particular reason, because it's so ubiquitous. It's used everywhere. Right. So if you're using Wi-Fi, you're using microwaves. It's a major aspect of our telecommunications technology. So, for example, the wireless network, the telephone, cell phone network uses microwave technology. And the telecommunications companies have sponsored lots of studies that said, it doesn't cause cancer, it's not dangerous, and we don't want to be liable for anything.
Correct.
So, it's like the cigarette, tobacco industry.
Exactly. But the difference between microwave radiation that is used in telecommunication and the microwave radiation that is potentially causing Havana syndrome, that one is spread out sort of equally in the same, just like radio waves in mm-hmm. every other direction, and the other one is directed, or as Dr. Giordano calls it now, directable. So it can be pointed to one's brain, but in order to point to one's brain, you need to know where to aim, and that is a big mystery of this Havana syndrome. Yes, the most plausible explanation by both the National Academy of Sciences and the latest DNI CIA report is directed pulse microwave energy. But how is it directed at the victim's brain? That is a billion-dollar question, I think.
I'm not sure whether it has to be directed at the brain. I mean, it just has to be directed at the body.
Okay, directed at the body. But then there were people in the same apartment where the embassy personnel resided, and there were people affected by it and not affected. So So the idea that it was just like evenly spread out just doesn't support what the evidence that we have.
Well, I mean, I can only speculate about this. I mean, I'm not a physicist. I'm not an engineer. So my knowledge is very limited in that respect. But I think you can target microwaves. So you can project it in a beam. Like a beam weapon, like a laser.
But you need to do something. So how do you find the target? How do you find the target to beam at? That's what I would like to hear your ideas. Like, do you have, you've gathered so much information in your book. So maybe you came across some kind of technology that would allow to accomplish that.
Well, one theory I came across, and I don't know how well documented that is that there are individual brainwave patterns. Mm-hmm. So the brain functions using waves to coordinate the various functions inside the brain. And that has a particular wave spectrum that is called extremely low frequency. And I think it goes from 1 hertz to 70 hertz, something like that. And there are unique brainwave patterns for an individual. So that is like a biometrics. It's unique to an individual. And if you can monitor brainwaves remotely with this kind of radar-like approach, so you're beaming some waves at a person, and then the waves are reflected, and then you can understand what the object was, what kind of frequency come back, or how the frequencies are altered when they come back. So that is a possibility as to how people might be individually identified and targeted.
Right. I believe what you're referring to is called brain fingerprinting. Is that in the same general area?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, but I agree with you that the science is there, that everybody's DNA has a resonant frequency. If it's a material object, it has a resonant frequency, and so by that frequency you can identify and find things because they would resonate to a certain frequency, and this is how it's a part of biometrics. I very much agree with your educated guess. I have another very important question I would like to ask you. Are you following the media coverage of Havana syndrome at all? Are you familiar with the recent article in the Zeit magazine, the major German publication, called Havana Syndrome, Embassy Intrigue?
No, I haven't read it. I mean, I looked at the Havana syndrome obviously once it happened, and so I was following it until 2020 or 21, but I haven't looked at more recent information about it.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'd just like to read a quote from that. This is very good a piece of investigative journalist. And this is the conversation we're having is really about the scientific aspects of it. But the fact that we don't have access to a lot of research is indicative of who might be really interested in this technology. Here's the quote that I wanted to read to you. When one scientist who conducts research into pulse microwaves published a short text about how microwave weapons work, the military immediately intervened, and we're talking about like recent 2 years, a significant chunk of his research budget comes from the Defense Department, and they threatened to suspend funding if he continued discussing his research. What do you make of it, Armin?
Well, that's quite plausible. I mean, I've looked into black projects and the unacknowledged aspects of government. So we know that there is a black budget. It's pretty huge in the United States. One figure that is, I think, already more than 10 years old is like $60 billion. And that goes into funding black projects. They're managed as so-called special access programs, and sometimes unacknowledged special access programs. According to William Arkin, there are thousands of classified research projects going on in the government. So he said, if you would compile a list of all those classified research projects, you would end up with a phone book size document. So it is a lot of a lot of things are going on in the government that are not subjected to normal democratic accountability mechanisms. So there is no possibility for Congress to keep an eye on what the military-industrial complex is sponsoring or what elements of the national security apparatus are doing. And yeah, that goes back to the very inception of the intelligence community in the United States. So from the start, the CIA was not subjected to the budgetary accountability. So there was a CIA Act of 1949 that allowed the CIA to receive funding from other government departments that were listed as other kinds of budget items. So there was not even an official budget item for the CIA. So not even the cumulative figure was available to Congress until the mid-1970s or so. And even now, we only have the total amount of money that is spent on the intelligence community and the Department of Defense, but we don't know the details. So it's very hard to understand what's going on in those classified programs. And I don't think that they are subjected to the necessary democratic accountability.
When it comes out of the expert's mouth like yours, this is very alarming. However, when regular citizens talk about it, it's usually called conspiracy theory. And I'm very pleased to hear it from you, because this is, I think, beyond a conspiracy. The what's going on is simply unacceptable, because I think it is not just a national security issue, it's a public safety issue. Do you think this is a public safety issue?
Well, I mean, however you define it, the problem is unaccountable government and the move towards totalitarianism. So that's kind of the end game, that we might end up in a totalitarian society where there is no individual freedom, where everything is under direct control of the government or the people who control the government. So we are losing our democracy and our freedoms. So that is the much bigger issue that is at stake. So I've read a lot about totalitarian governments. I've done a lot of reading on the Third Reich and the Soviet Union. I think I understand how they operate. They always want to increase the control over the population. They think that that they only can tolerate people who think alike. They do not tolerate dissent. And what they do is isolate dissenters and ultimately eliminate dissenters. So that is a very dark future if nothing is done to stop it.
What do you think can be done or could be done to stop that progression of techno-totalitarianism that you pictured for us so well?
I mean, I think there is now more resistance forming across the world. I mean, we're seeing it with respect to the COVID restrictions. So the governments around the world have decided to take away more and more freedoms in the name of public health. And as it's typically the case, once a government gained certain powers, they are not willing to give up those powers. And that is the situation we are finding ourselves in. So if we are not resisting this tendency towards greater and greater control, and then we end up in a complete totalitarian society. And that is very dangerous. So we know that the totalitarian regimes always turned to genocide.
Yes.
So
I couldn't agree more with your conclusions. This is the direction it's going. And I think it has to become a political issue. And regular citizens should be aware of it. In your book, you suggest what steps we might take. One of them is educating the public, ending secrecy, which I think is probably the hardest part. But what else can a regular people that are now aware of these technological advancements and the totalitarian aspirations, what can regular people do?
Well, I mean, there is an upside to mind control. It works best when people are not aware of it. So once people have become aware of mind control, they are now in a better position to resist it. Mm-hmm. And I think much of the mind control that has been happening over so many decades is now breaking down. So more and more people no longer buy into the mainstream narrative. I mean, there is a widespread rejection of the media narratives or the mainstream media narratives that are put out. And there is far less trust in the government. I mean, I would say at least a third of the population is now aware that something is very wrong. And what we can do is disobey unmoral and illegitimate orders from the government. I mean, there are some lessons to be learned from the resistance to totalitarian regimes as it happened in the Third Reich as well as in the Soviet Union. I mean, it might take a long time to overcome it, but eventually I think the human spirit that we want freedom will succeed. So we are in a long battle.
We are. That's it. That's a very optimistic message. And I wish that more people listen to this message. You and I are talking about this. We are not a part of mainstream media. We're just two people concerned about the future of our country and the future of humanity, quite frankly. Is there anything else you would like to, because this is a perfect ending to our conversation. Is there anything else you would like to tell people who are listening to this conversation?
Well, it's time to switch off the television and to do some serious learning. I mean, I believe in education. That's the reason why I'm a professor. So I believe there is some power in gaining knowledge. And the more knowledge we have, the more capable we are to resist and just these kinds of evil powers. So,
thank you very much, Dr. Krishnan. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I wish you all the best in your research. What's next for you? Are there any new projects that you're getting involved in, or this is just a continuation of your main line of work?
Well, yeah, I'm working on a new book on fifth generation warfare. So that is a related topic. So it deals with the manipulation of perception. So it's sometimes called cognitive warfare. And yeah, the main idea in fifth generation warfare is that the target that is being attacked is not even aware that they are under attack or who the attacker is. So we are living in very confusing times. I wanted to develop some theory about that.
That is extremely interesting. I think you touched upon that subject in your recent book and call it ambiguous for warfare. Is that sort of the direction it is going?
Yes, I think so. So the modes of attack become very unusual. So you're not really associating the things that are being used against you with an attack. So we are disguising the attack as something that is benign. And that makes it much more difficult to resist and overcome.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. That's Armin, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much and good luck in your future endeavors.
Yeah, I also wish you good luck. And I hope that the Havana syndrome that you're suffering from will end, so that there is an end at all of this.
I don't know how, but from your mouth to God's ears. Thank you.
Yeah. Have a nice day.
You too.
Bye.